Okay, tough one to follow. For me, this is a little different approach. I was asked last year to prepare something with respect to this topic and honestly didn't know very much about it. As a basic scientist, my exposure to plant breeding and plant biology was rather thin. It was much more technical basic science in molecular biology. And what I've really realized is Vavilov is right up there with Norman Borlaug in terms of names that household names that aren't. And it really is amazing to learn about what he did and his impacts on what we do today. What I would like to do today is imagine to look forward in the looking glass, that if Vavilov were to be alive today, would some of the principles that he had founded back then, how would they apply or not apply today based upon the tools with molecular resolution? And so we'll talk a little bit about the laws of homologous variation and genetic variability, and how some very key traits that have been selected through domestication, or wild traits that have been selected, show that the same kind of rules do still apply. And the law of homologous series basically states that closely related organisms show parallel variations in shared traits. And that's not necessarily, it doesn't seem so surprising at first, but when we think about how this, what this really means, it's that similar plants in a similar geographical situation under similar selection forces will tend to adopt the similar alleles or similar changes in genes that later are reflected in terms of traits. Now, of course, we're talking about this before we speak about genes, but Vavilov is thinking about traits, the traits that were changing in plants in parallel species. And so let me move forward to the next one. The law had a few different statements that were applied to it, that the more similar the species, the more similar variations will be, and that there are common characters that occur in similar species of a given genetic or geographical background. And that's an important consideration when we lay this on the backdrop of the idea of centers of diversity, that there are certain changes or certain traits that we see in common species in that area. So so Vavilov, there's a couple of assumptions. The first postulate was that there was a high degree in local diversity, that this was an indicator that of a center of domestication, and that it was all founded really on the assumption that each domestication event only occurred once, and could point to certain examples of how that may have happened. It turns out that probably isn't true when we look at molecular resolution. I'll show us a little bit of data that supports that today. And this partially is because of diversity can come from other sources rather than just selection, that you can have outcrossing that comes in, other influences that are affecting a given trait. And there's many good examples of that from the literature. What I'll talk about today are just a couple of different traits where you can, that have been very well dissected, domestication traits that have been very well dissected at the molecular level, and then show you that the laws of homologous series, that parallel changes in different species that have somewhat related, do have a foundation, that they're not just the traits, that there are specific genes that are affected in parallel. And it maybe doesn't seem like such a surprise, but when we think about quantitative traits and many genes that are contributing to a given trait, maybe we would assume that maybe we wouldn't see this as strong as we do, but you see some very common changes that occur between evolving or traits that are under selection. The first one I'll talk about is seed dispersal. And one of the major domestication events that has occurred that occurred in human history in grasses is the seeds sticking to the inflorescence. That when in its native form, the seeds fall off of the seed heads and for distribution. And one of the big steps in domestication was when lines of plants were identified where the seeds were retained. And this allowed humans to collect the plant materials and thresh them or otherwise harvest them later. It was a big deal in terms of human harvesting and transportation, and also didn't promote radiation of weedy species. And maybe this doesn't show up. I guess it shows up okay. So what this the way we think about this is that this kind of falling off of the seed head as a shattering trait versus non-shattering. And what you find is that there are a number, depending on the species you look at, if you look across grasses, domesticated grasses, that there are a number of different mutations which can lead to this. And which really kind of, so a trait which is being framed by quantitatively by a number of different genes. But what you do find is that there are a number of genes which, well, I should say, let's say with respect to shattering, that there's one or two genes which really do have very strong effects on this. And it's pretty profound how these are conserved throughout human selection. One good example is in sorghum. Now, sorghum is an example where multiple domestication events occurred in one, with respect to sorghum, that wild species were domesticated around the seed shattering trait or the seed retention trait, but occurred independently three different times through three different types of wild sorghum. And the major domesticated traits are noted as this SC265, those three numbers there. And it was postulated by Andy Patterson back in the 90s that the same gene that's underlying the retention of the seed in sorghum is probably what's doing it in most grasses. And I'll show you some cases where that does and doesn't hold. At the time, it was hypothesized that a conserved mechanism would underlie seed retention in all grasses, along with rice, maize, millet, etc. It turns out that in sorghum, and this is a little bit of an exception rather than a rule, so this is why I bring this up, is that it's controlled by a single locus. And when you get down to do the genetic mapping, turns out this is a locus called SH1, which turns out to encode a transcription factor. So a protein which is regulating gene expression on a slightly more global level that is then affecting some trait which is affecting the seed retention. And again, that this actually happened, at least, so mutations in this one transcription factor were selected by humans in three different contexts from three different wild populations for the same trait, because the trait was that useful. If we think about this in terms of the idea of homologous series, that here's the evolution of a given trait, or the selection of a given trait in three completely independent contexts because of its value, because of its use for those who are making the selection. So what is really exciting about this in terms of thinking about it from a more modern day standpoint is that here you're looking at three separate mutations and three different selection events all in the same SH1 gene. And when you look at this in terms of letters on the board, it's framed, let's see, I have a pointer here. Basically what you're looking at, and actually it's best to start out here with point D, that you're looking at wild forms of sorghum and then the three different domesticated mutations. That the first two are point mutations, which you can see maybe lead to some quantitative, the smudge on the little band here just simply says the lower levels are lower. This one is a truncation of that original type. This one probably looks a little bit shorter too, or maybe has some other change that's occurred inside the sequence. But essentially, these are all three of them were point mutations, one single polymorphism that led to the same trait with the defect in the same protein that led to retention of the seed on the seed head. So do we see the same thing in other grains? And here's an example from rice. And this is, again, the same mutation in the SH1 gene. And what you're looking at are examples of that rice which is maintained versus that which comes off. And the authors do basically the assay is, can you squeeze it and bend it and do the seeds fall off? And it turns out that it's like one locus in rice, and that when you look in rice, you find that if you look at, when they say pulling, under that pressure, you see that there's the differences between the shattering and non-shattering types of rice. Between the non-shattering and the shattering types of rice. What it is it's a difference that occurs here at the base of the grain. And if you look at that, where are we going here? If we look at this microscopically, it's just small differences in the cell layer at that juncture and the structure of that cell layer at that juncture that maintains that that grain based upon the sequence of the SH1 gene. And if you go over to this panel over here, it shows you again that this is just a single base pair substitution that underlies this particular domestication event in rice. That this one single trait governs the ability to retain the seed versus lose the seed. And so to go back again and put this in the context of that homologous series, that parallel series may be expected to have parallel traits, parallel genes underneath them. Here you're looking at that level of resolution that shows the same gene is affected in a different species. And this is where it shows how this slide shows a completely different gene also controlling that same trait. So this is where it starts to split between traits and the genes that control them. That here there's a separate locus defined by association mapping, which is a completely different type of transcription factor, but also plays a role in the retention of the seed on the seed head. And really all this, and I won't go into the heavy-duty details of what this all means, but suffice it to say, this is a different kind of transcription factor that if you compare, and these panels just show its relative abundance. So this is measuring RNA levels in different tissues. What this is really showing, and the take-home message is that in the shattering versus the non-shattering, the gene expression is remarkably different. And that's just simply saying that in the that there's something else happening at the molecular level from a separate locus, which is governing the retention of seed on the plant. So this is, let me skip ahead to this one. This one really kind of brings it home, is that if you look at this SH1 locus and compare really remarkably different species, when you compare corn versus rice versus sorghum, what you're looking at here are you're looking at, or this is comparing against sorghum here on this axis. So you're looking basically along the real estate of the chromosome, and then on the, and what you're looking at on the, well, let me put it this way. If you're comparing these genomes stretched out, that chromosome stretched out, chromosome 1 or 5 or 3, in the respective species, that there's some degree of collinearity, that you're seeing some places where it aligns and doesn't, where it aligns and doesn't align. But where this line goes across here, it's highlighting a red dot, which is this locus for SH1, that there are these large regions of the chromosome containing this locus that have apparently been under some sort of selection for the retention of this particular trait. And this slide shows a little bit more detail about that SH1 locus and how it's different in each individual plant, that it's actually in each individual species, that the native allele up top is contrasted versus the alleles from corn or rice by different insertions that have actually occurred. So they're all parallel insertions. They're insertions which have homologous insertions. They all have the same effect by limiting the effect of the SH1 gene all through remarkably different mechanisms. But again, it's an interesting thought that here are basically molecular signatures of human domestication events, that humans selected the trait because of its value and all based upon different naturally occurring changes inside the genome. Let me scoot ahead to, I guess this one is another one that maybe is a little bit more a little bit more interesting, because it is all of the variation is based upon a single base pair change. And this is in replimulus. This is again a shattering trait or a seed retention trait in brassicas. And really what you're looking at here are cross sections of the junction with the silique, and this is all governed. The structure of this area is governed by a protein called replimulus, and the variation occurs. If you look at the variation between Arabidopsis and other brassicas, there's quite a bit of variation that's occurring inside this region of right before this particular mutation. There's variation between these, but when you look at them where this mutation occurred, which changes its ability to retain, it's in that one single base pair difference. And this is reflected here very nicely, that when you look at Arabidopsis, Capsella versus Brassicas, that the domesticated branch of this all show a different... it's hard to touch that without moving it. They show a... let's do it this way. How about that? They all show a single conserved change that is really reminiscent of this of the idea of domestication that's not found up in these. The ability to retain that seed. Scoot ahead to photoperiodic flowering, and this is another really important trait that both for ecological reasons or for human selection comes under tremendous pressure. And we may hypothesize that common changes that occur in terms of photoperiodic flowering response may be based on a number of shared genes or set of genes. And I'll show you a really nice example of how this holds to be true with respect to roses and strawberries. The reason that you may have such pressure is because you're talking about reproduction, and to be able to get flowering, synchronous flowering has some very nice advantages, such as being able to match pollinators or match the timing of different plants in the same species. But at the same time, if you take away flowering control, where plants are ever-bearing or potentially or recurrent, this gives an important selection trait for humans. One of the great reasons you might domesticate something, because it's always providing some flowers or fruit. And in the cases of rose, it's easy to think about why that would be a very valuable trait during domestication, that roses that would continually flower would have significant value. And if you contrast that against strawberries, again, there's another fruit that has an ever-bearing habit or some remittent habit would have a tremendous value to someone who is selecting. So we might predict that in roses and strawberries that these traits would have some value, and the genes that are involved may be similar. And flowering is controlled by a mess. It's a number of different pathways that all bleed into this idea of flowering. And I put this up here not to go through it in excruciating detail, but more to suggest that there may be there's a number of different nodes where you could interrupt the flowering response. And what I'll show you in this case is that you're actually interfering with flowering somewhere in this particular area over here. And that there's a shared gene in rose and in strawberry which has been interrupted to provide a common trait in parallel species. This paper came out a couple of years ago. It was actually spelled this out very nicely, that this TFL homolog, this protein called KSM1, that this would regulate continuous flowering in rose and strawberry. And it turns out this interferes over in this arm of this pathway. And turns out that that the way that the researchers found this was that they were studying recurrent flowering in roses, and it turns out that they had this mapped down to a region of chromosome 5, linkage group 5, that had a parallel region, at least looked like by linkage markers, in strawberry that had some flowering associated genes there. And so it suggested that maybe this was that these two recurrent flowering traits had some sort of common genetic underpinning. And what they were able to do was amplify the regions of flowering associated genes in both genomes and check for some sort of a lesion that would cause there to be a disruption of the gene. And it turns out the same gene in rose was also disrupted in strawberry. And these two are shown down over here. So here's a good example of, now let me go forward and show the physical nature of that. So what it turned out to be is that in rose, the once flowering versus continuous flowering, that the continuous flowering gene was disrupted by a copia-like transposon insertion. So this is disrupted. Now this gene doesn't function and flowering occurs more readily. It turns out that this is actually a repressor of flowering, a negative regulator of flowering. So now flowering can occur any time. The same thing happens in strawberry, that when this group went and sequenced strawberry, you found that that there was a truncation in this particular gene. And if you look across the strawberry types of those that are regulated versus those that are have less photoperiodic response, that they show the truncation of this gene making it ineffective in regulating flowering. So why this is exciting is that here's a trait that was selected for and domesticated under two different in parallel species in two separate homologous series that were that have a common genetic link underneath them, just like the SH1 gene did in control of shattering. This just extends the same kind of idea to other species where this one actually goes to, this same thing was found in soybean and whichever flower this is, crocus, where the same genes, the same TFL gene is disrupted. So the way I'd like to conclude on that is that, and I don't even have to go into the specific traits, that when we look in homologous series, look across grasses and find that this one very important trait, when selected, tended to have a common genetic underpinning, at least as a major allele that was contributing to domestication in across really diverse species and in diverse areas of the world. Photoperiodic flowering control, even in species that are quite different, share a common lesion, which was likely the basis of domestication. So I think that if Vavilov would have had the opportunity to employ molecular tools to study the diversity that he was seeing in the parallel traits, he probably would have been pretty well amazed to find that there were common genetic elements that were governing them as well. So.
Thank you, Dave.
We have a little time, so I think if you have any questions for the first two talks, now that's in your mind, we'll take them on. Any questions on Volta? Any questions on Janik? Question?
Jules, you mentioned that his aristocratic or his wealthy background played into his demise.
Yeah.
But also his genetic theory played into his demise. How did his background and his wealthy background play into his situation?
Well, with the rise of so-called the common man, if you were an aristocratic, this was not a good thing. His father had to finally leave the country, and he was always suspected maybe of being a spy, and so coming from a middle-class bourgeois background did not help you in the emerging communist system in Russia. So this was considered a mark against him. I think, does that answer the question? It wasn't a good thing to come from the middle class. He wasn't really aristocracy, but he certainly was middle class. Questions? If not, we'll continue. Kim?